Well, hello. My name's Glyn Harrison. I'm a member of the church family here at All Souls, husband to Louise, who helps with the children's work. And it might be helpful if I say I'm a psychiatrist by trade, in understanding one or two of the insights we're going to bring to the passage from the Bible we read together today. So here's the question. What happens when you put up a video of a small group of people passing basketballs between them and you ask people watching the video to count the number of times the ball gets passed, but not by anybody, just the people wearing the white t-shirts? And then while they're busy doing that, you arrange for somebody dressed in a human-sized gorilla costume to walk into the middle of the screen, look at the camera, beat their chests, and then stroll off. Astonishingly, only half of the people watching the video actually see the gorilla. The other half, so busy looking for the ball, they miss the gorilla altogether because, you see, it's not what they're looking for. Well, this is one of the most famous psychological studies ever. But the findings are essentially the same as many similar studies. They all point to the same thing. We as human beings can be so absorbed with the task in hand, we simply don't see things we don't expect to see, even when they're staring us in the face. And I wonder whether you notice the protagonist in the story we read together, Jacob. He had something like this experience. Did you see it there in verse 16? When Jacob awoke from his sleep, he thought, surely the Lord is in this place. And I was not aware of it. Here is a man, you see, so absorbed in his own world, so locked down in his own schemes, that he nearly misses a life-changing encounter with the God of the universe. The Lord is here, he says, and I could have walked on by. And you know, I wonder in the middle of this pandemic whether there isn't a risk too that something like that could be happening in our lives. The experience of being locked down. I don't just mean the physical reality of that, but some of us locked down by our worries and anxiety, maybe locked down by anger, or locked down by an obsession with the news cycle that just keeps on coming and we just keep checking, or by resentment at the loss of control over our lives, or the treadmill of trying to regain control. So locked down by events that we're in danger of missing out on the realities of God that are staring us in the face. Indeed, is there a danger that we might be missing out at this time of our lives on God altogether? So look, let's dig into this story to see what it's got to teach us, shall we? Three questions, one, two, three. One, who was Jacob? What's his story? Two, what happened to Jacob to open the way for this extraordinary encounter with God? Three, how did Jacob respond to his encounter with God? So first, who was Jacob, the man at the center of the story? Well, it's a poignant question because the central mission of Jacob's whole life up until this point has been to get himself to the center of the story, his story. He's a character marked by cunning and manipulation of other people in pursuit of his own ends. Twice he robbed his own brother, his twin brother Esau, first of his inherited birthright and second of his father's blessing. He deceived his own father. He lied outrageously to him. Well, you know, his little hand was even grasping onto his twin brother's heel as he was being born. He'd even managed to be born into the world making use of somebody else, you see. And when they playfully named him Jacob, which actually means he who grasps the heel, Little did they realize how prophetic that would be. Jacob, the grasper, the supplanter, an altogether unpleasant piece of work. You know, I suspect that today Jacob would be fascinated, perhaps even drawn to the burgeoning fraud industry in this country, in which clever people manipulate little people, unsuspecting people, vulnerable people, and they make off with their life savings. That's Jacob. And yet, here's the thing. In the Old Testament, there are three men with whom God most frequently associates his name. If you look there in verse 13, you'll see that God announces himself to Jacob with two of those names. He says, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. But here's the thing, henceforth, God will announce himself as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because these are the three generations, grandfather, father, and son, from whom God will pursue his long-term plan to build a nation, that he'll call to be a light to the nations, and from whom one day he'll bring a savior to the world. But in a way, that simply sharpens the question, doesn't it? I mean, why on earth would God want to identify himself as the God of Jacob? Couldn't he find somebody more worthy to be called into his purpose? But if you know anything about the God of the Bible, you'll know that over and over and over again, it's just the way he works. He seems to be drawn. He has a heart for the outsider, the undeserving, the hopeless case. He's the God of the difficult personality and the warped temperament. And where others have given up in despair, that's where this God likes to begin. And this is what makes the Christian story a story of hope and possibility, you see, because if God can be a God to Jacob, he can be a God to you, to me. So our second question, how did this man, Jacob, come to meet God after all? Well, as this passage tells us, he met God because and only because God met him. At this point in the story, God is, I tell you, he's the last thing on Jacob's mind. He's got a price on his head. His brother Esau, a powerful, strong man, he's finally snapped in the face of his brother's deception. He vows to kill him, and Jacob is on the run. With his survival instinct in overdrive, Jacob just doesn't have the cognitive space at this point in his life to look out, to look beyond himself. His mind is focused on saving his skin. And if God had not met Jacob, he wouldn't have met God at all. And you see, friends, this is what's so dangerous about fear and resentment and anger and the lust for control. Because when these things take root in our hearts like a whirlpool, they only ever draw us deeper into ourselves. So that when the unexpected comes knocking at our door, we shout, go away, or we fail to hear it altogether. So what happened here to change that? Well, it was in a dream, verse 10. We pick up the story. And in his dream, an extraordinary staircase suddenly opens up before Jacob. It stretches all the way. It stretches from earth, the place of mortals and graspers, way up into the sky, into the stars, and into heaven, place of the angels, the sphere of God. And he sees angels, the supernatural messengers of God, ascending and descending on this staircase. Could one of them be I don't know, is one of them carrying a message for him? No, because suddenly there is God himself. Hebrews are a little unclear as to whether God is standing above or beside him, but that's beside the point. God himself has come to speak with this man. And to his astonishment, he discovers in verse 13 that the God of the universe wants to be a God to him and to make something of his life. So, if God appears directly, we say, well, what's the meaning of the staircase? Do we need the staircase? Well, fast forward hundreds of years to the time of Jesus, and you'll discover that Jesus actually interprets the fullest meaning of this dream for us. We don't have time just now. You can look it up in John chapter 1, verse 50. But as you read it, you'll find a beautiful story there of a young man called Nathanael. And he's astonished because Jesus just seems to know everything about him before they met. And Jesus looks at Nathanael and he says, Nathanael, you believe in me because I told you I saw you sitting under a fig tree before we'd even met? You shall see greater things than that. For I tell you, verse 51, he says, you shall see heaven open, Nathanael, and the angels of God, from the words here, ascending and descending on the Son of Man. And do you see what Jesus is saying here? He is the staircase that stretches between the place of graspers and twisters and broken people into the stars and into the God of the universe himself. And back to Jacob's dream here in shadow form. Jacob's being shown that one day God himself will stand in the gap between earth and heaven and reconcile schemers and graspers to himself. And he will be their God. And he's come to bring them home. Now look, if you happen to be just listening in on this in a kind of a just looking into Christianity mode, it's great to have you. Thank you. And I just invite you to think about this for a moment. Of course, this passage raises lots of questions. But if there is a God, if there is a supreme being, wouldn't you want him to look something like this? God who stoops down to those who deserve it the least. A God who doesn't wait for us to be interested in him before he takes the profoundest interest in us. A God who says in his own son Jesus that I will lay down my life on a cross, taking all of the wrongdoing that has fractured this world and your life into myself, and I will rebuild a highway from earth to heaven for you. Wouldn't you want him, if there is a God, to be a God like that? I just want to say, what if he is like that? Isn't that worth looking into some more? And so, third and final question, how did Jacob respond to this encounter with God? But before then, let's take a moment to reflect on what we've heard. So how did Jacob respond to this extraordinary encounter? Two very different ways. First, he was overwhelmed. He was overwhelmed with a sense of awe. That's awe spelt A-W-E, not the rowing kind. Do you see it there in verse 18? He said he was afraid. And he said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. Awe. Now, awe is a complex emotion. It's part a sense of wonder, wonder in the face of splendor or beauty. It's part a sense of fear, fear in the face of mystery, something not easily understood. As one psychologist put it, it's the sense of being overwhelmed by greatness. And psychologists call awe a decentering emotion. Decentering, just a fancy term, really, for our human ability to step back outside of ourselves, to see ourselves as part of a bigger picture. A story that meaningfully involves me, but which isn't all about me. Just a few weeks ago, the BBC ran a story, I don't know whether you saw it, about a psychological study into the benefits of undertaking a weekly awe walk. Once a week, for 2 months, participants committed to go on a 15-minute walk when they would make a sustained effort to appreciate the world around them. And they promised to make a real effort to get their heads out of their devices and into the world. And how would they do that? I imagine some would focus on the soaring beauty of a dawn on a clear winter morning. For others, maybe it was just standing for minutes on end before the relentless crashing the waves on a huge deserted beach, or the crunch underfoot of golden leaves, and you've never really noticed them before, and you focus and ponder on how they'll return to dust before again one day being woven into that mighty oak. Of course they had to work at it. All of our devices, they're programmed to hijack our attention. The existence of the media in all its forms depends entirely on its ability to capture our attention. Attention, it's the most valuable commodity in the world. And the easiest way of getting our attention is to fill our minds with fear, to center us again, you see, in what they want us to see and into ourselves. So it's not easy. But here's the thing. Over time, compared with a control group, a comparison group, the people who undertook these awe walks once a week for 2 months reported feeling better. They reported decreasing negative emotions and an increasing sense of well-being. There was another interesting finding too. The researchers asked participants to take one selfie during their awe walk. And over time, the researchers found that people who took the regular awe walks in their selfies shifted out of the center of the picture and off to the side, sometimes even down to the corner. More evidence, you see, that participants were learning to de-center themselves in relation to the bigger world, a smaller self, but somehow a bigger connection with the world they inhabit. And here's the question for us tonight. Friends, can there be any experience more decentering in this way than to be invited by the God of the worlds into his story? That's what God in his Son Jesus wants to do with us now. To be overwhelmed by the greatness of grace. Well, I said two different kinds of response, didn't I? We'd better have a quick look at the other. The second comes next morning when Jacob finally wakes up and he rubs his eyes, and his response now couldn't be more different. We find him in verse 20 trying to do a deal with God, and here's the deal. In verse 20, he says, if God will be with me and will watch over me on this journey I am taking, and will give me food to eat and clothes to wear, so that I return safely to my father's house, then the Lord will be my God. And of all that you give me, he says to God, I'll give you a tenth. Well, it isn't hard to see who gets the best part of that deal, is it? You see, the old Jacob is back in the driving seat. And he's got a lot to learn, hasn't he? He's got a lot to learn about himself. He's got a lot to learn about the God who has broken into his life. But when Jacob finally limps out of the pages of the book of Genesis a few chapters later, he'll be a changed man. He'll be changed because he'll have learned to respond to God with more of the first of these two responses, awe and worship, and less of the second. Like the psalmist, he'll have learned to say, "Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together." If you're a follower of Christ, I just want to ask, is worship one of the casualties of this lockdown for you? Of course, it's incredibly tough for some of us, especially right now, anxious, worried. But still, could we be so busy looking down, we're forgetting how to look up in worship and wonder before the God we serve, and missing out on his blessing in our lives? So here's an idea, and we're going to end with this. How about committing to a weekly awe walk between now and Christmas? Let's take our encouragement from Job 37, where we read, "Stop and consider God's wonders." London's one of the greenest cities in the world. Maybe a frosty afternoon as a golden sun sets across a London park. You have to be intentional, but maybe notice that tree. It was possibly here when you were born, and it'll possibly be there when you die. And look up and look out and learn to experience awe in the rhythms of God's creation. God's creation. But don't stop there. Oh no. As nature cultivates the experience of being part of a story bigger than yourself, why not let this word tonight flesh out that story so that we experience ourselves not as simply being part of a story that is bigger than ourselves. We experience ourselves as being part of the story that is bigger than ourselves. The story of Jesus, Savior of the world, who stooped down and made himself our stairway to heaven, to God himself. And now our awe walk will have become a worship walk, which is better still. Are you up for that? Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together.